Welcome to the Men of 8 Gang Podcast, episode 140. I'm Steve Borsch, and I am on with Tim Elliott.
I'm here.
Graham Thickens.
Yeah, I'm here too, but I'm still in mourning.
Yeah, no kidding. Phil Wilson.
Yo!
Back from his big travels, and our very special guest host, Julio Ojeda Zapata.
Hello.
How are you guys this morning?
Groggy.
Groggy? Yeah. Well, Phil's
I'm working on Seattle time, so, but I'm other than that, I'm good.
Yeah.
Yep, it's good.
Yeah. So
I get to see that Graham had gone to mini demo.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And did more mini than demo.
That's right.
Really?
The mini, okay. Mini part. The gab part. Yeah. I talk about event burnout. 3 in 3 days was almost killed me.
Wow.
But it was fun.
Well, how was it? How was mini demo?
Well, you know, it was crowded and it was hot. Those are the two things that come to mind. But there were some awesome people there and awesome connections made. And to me, that's more important than anything, you know. It was a long evening that extended afterwards to an after party. But I was running out of steam by about 11. And I'm sure that went till 12 or 1.
Yep.
So big turnout, great venue. I'll tell you, the food and the refreshments get better every time, and the event went without a hitch. It was televised for later viewing, I guess, or recorded for later viewing. I don't know if that's up there yet, but. I think it was 10 demos, or maybe it was 8 or 9. I didn't get the actual final count. Some of them we knew about that were larger companies that were more established, like 8th Bridge.
Yeah, right.
And others were sort of brand new things that no one had really ever heard about. So check them out. I did the post with the link to the list of startups.
Right. Well, then, Graham, you and I, Tuesday night, were at the tech cocktail event that Kim Gerritsen drove.
Oh, yeah, that was. You know, and that's a different kind of a format, but you know what? I really like it, and I think it's, and at least one of the startups I know that was at both events said he likes that format better for the startup that's pitching, because they get a table. And people come around and talk to you one-on-one at your table. And it's just a different kind of a format, but it obviously works. They've done it in 20 cities now.
Yeah. Well, that's, and for those that, sorry. Well, for those that weren't there, go to the post that Graham did, because you can see some photos. But I felt exactly the same way that, it's great to sit through a 5 to 7 minute value prop pitch, but then I always have like 47 questions. So I'd much rather walk over, have somebody give me a 3 minute overview and then ask questions. I know it doesn't scale the same way. But yeah, that was really a great venue. And that actually, did you guys ever go to Twin Cities Strictly Business Expo? Anybody go to that?
I think I've been to one of those. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember that. Yeah.
So that was always a big thing and a great get together and so on. But I keep thinking about a tech event where there would be like a little mini trade show. So there'd be, you know, some big draw, but then you know, you'd have tables set up where people could mingle and have it be like an open house and just come and go all day. Mm-hmm. I think it'd be terrific.
Yeah.
So what about that Edutech event?
Oh, that was pretty amazing too. I am starting to really get impressed with the amount of technology we have in our education sector in this state. And it's being talked about now like it's a new cluster. And I think it's
Is it really?
Real. Oh yeah, I think it's for real. I mean, there were some pretty amazing companies, and I didn't link to all of them on my post, but I particularly went there to talk to the KidBlog guys again,
right?
Because they're just, as far as number of users, they're, you know, going to the moon with that thing. But click through to the site and read about the startups that pitch there. Some of them you're aware of. Everyone's aware of Nike. They're all over the place because they won the Minnesota Cup. And
right.
So, and they were at Mini Demo too. So I've heard their pitch about three times, you know, but they're just the beginning. There's a lot of other pretty cool stuff in this state too.
Well, and you know, the one thing that most people don't remember is that during the Apple II days, the Minnesota Educational Computing Consortium, which later became a for-profit corporation, MEC, was the educational software leader in the country.
Yeah.
And it was a big, big, big deal. And so there's a lot of precedent for, and then of course, controlled data with Plato.
Plato, where I was,
Bill Norris's career. Thing, yeah. I mean, it was, there's a lot of precedent here for really phenomenal educational technology, and it really looks like Capella, you know, based on our podcast last week, is doing a lot in this space as well.
Yeah, and they were a sponsor of the event too. So speaking of those old days, Steve, well, going back to the 90s anyway, there were a couple of references to the Oregon Trail thing. Remember there are still, that legacy is still out there, and people who are involved in that are now involved in some of these more recent things too. I heard that mentioned. I didn't sit through all the pitches. I was only there for about 3 or 4 hours, but the important part is I was there for the session in the afternoon when I felt Steve Jobs in the room.
And that, I saw that, you wrote about that.
That freaked me out, man. I mean, and I get home and an hour or two later, we hear he died. And I think he was dying right about the time I was sitting in that room. And I thought, oh my God. And it forced me to write a tribute, you know, about how his company's technologies are changing education so amazingly, you know. But I was hearing these guys on the panel talk about it with such passion. I couldn't believe it. It was like, my God, you know, the influence this guy had in his company on education. And I thought of you having been involved in selling into the education market for them, right?
Well, that was part of it, but that was early. Yeah. Well, I remember, and we obviously want to acknowledge that that's the number one story for the week is the passing of Steve Jobs. But in 1983, I was working for a firm called Clothier Herald here. And, we all went out because they had an international sales meeting in Hawaii in 1983 in November. And so people from around the world came to this thing. And that's when Steve introed the Mac to the company and also showed us the 1984 ad that was going to show up on the Super Bowl. And then later on, we had a big party and that MASH, the TV show, was a huge deal at the time. And there was a MASH party, and Jobs and Scully came in by a MASH-type helicopter, you know, laying in the gurneys on each side and climbed out, you know. And so that was but what was interesting about what you just said about educational technology and everything else is that it's hard to fathom. I didn't think I'd react this way. Because I knew, you know, just watching him over the course of the last few months, and whenever you'd see him, it just, you know, it was pretty clear that he was downtrending pretty dramatically. Mm-hmm. But I was not expecting that I'd have this kind of reaction. Julio, you obviously have spent a lot of time out in the Bay Area lately. And what was your reaction?
To Steve Jobs passing?
Yeah.
I compare it to how I felt long ago when Isaac Asimov died. It was both those deaths were just kind of punches in the gut because these are people that I just I didn't know, but I idolized and you know felt close to. And so it hit me surprisingly hard.
Yeah,
me too.
Well, and then we had the Apple iPhone 4S announcement, and there have been a lot of people backpedaling over their comments. Robert Scoble is the most visible example of that, about sort of saying, hey, I'm sorry about raining on your parade. I had no idea. And so, you know, there's been a lot of interesting buzz and talk about, Samsung and Google postponed the Nexus Prime with Ice Cream Sandwich, the Android, next version of the Android, out of respect for Steve. But also people have said, well, you know, it's maybe why the iPhone 5 didn't show, because they knew that it would be eclipsed by something and it just didn't make sense to do it. Yeah. And they want
I don't think that's the case at all.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That doesn't make sense.
Well,
I think that the 4S looks like a great product. I don't see why everyone was disappointed.
Pre-orders sold. Well, it's already in the
US. It's a great product. There's no doubt about it. The reason people are disappointed is it's not any sexier than it was before.
Yeah, it is. It's a totally new inside, and it's got Siri voice stuff that's groundbreaking.
No. It's all.
And you can buy it on Sprint, Phil.
No, it's all about looks, baby. You know that.
Yeah, everybody wanted that. It's all about looks.
But this is normal. This is normal. They always skip the looks every other generation.
Yeah.
Now this one is gone. This one's gone on for another 6 months, you know.
It's a great phone, but, you know, guys, you gotta stop and wonder why not a change in screen size at the very least. You know, that's the one thing that's probably just a wee bit disappointing. Not that I'm saying the screen size is bad, because the resolution on that screen is kick butt, and it's always been great. I like it a lot better than the 4.3 screen size on my Evo. But my question is, you know, why not?
Are you talking about a physically larger size?
A physically larger size screen.
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense for reasons that have been discussed on a couple of posts. If you hold the phone in your hand, your thumb can get anywhere on the screen. You can press anywhere. If you take one of the bigger Android phones, there are parts of the screen that you can't reach one-handed.
Oh, come on. Come on now, Stubby. You can reach that.
And I think that's primarily the reason. It's just kind of a physical comfort thing. People at Apple, I can just see them sort of experimenting with different screen sizes and trying to use the phone one-handed. And I think the iPhone is just exactly the right size. And some of those Android phones, you know, with their massive screens, you put them in your pocket and they just feel huge. I think the iPhone 4 is just perfect.
Yeah, there's a guy
Julio,
that did a
you
post.
Gotta admit, Julio, admittedly, you're a fanboy, so of course it's perfect.
No, I mean, I'm talking about the physical dimensions. I love the bigger Android screens. They look spectacular, but I feel clumsy trying to use one of those phones one-handed. I'm in the car or something, and I think the practicality of that is primarily the reason the phone has stayed the same size.
Now Julio, your mother and I have talked to you about using your phone in the car.
You can edit that in post, right?
Yeah, right. Exactly, but only when you're at stoplights, I heard.
Maybe those big Android phones are for long-fingered piano players only. I don't know. But I thought
it's a great phone. No, don't get me wrong, guys. It's a great phone, and yes, it doesn't have the sexy stuff, but I tell you know, the download speeds, the dual core processor, the Siri is it's okay. You know, I don't know how many times I'm going to be talking to my phone, but it's a great little concept. But it's a great phone, no doubt. But it just didn't. The reason it didn't fly so well is because it didn't have the sexy bent on it. There was nothing greatly enhanced about the exterior physical part of the phone.
Well, and the rumor mill was telling us all kinds of things about a larger screen and showing us all these cases being made in China. I love the post or the tweet I saw yesterday. Somebody wrote a story about, would anybody like to buy $2 million or 2 million iPhone 5 cases or something like that? You know, supposedly all these things were being used over there, getting ready for the new teardrop or whatever they call it, the you know, tapered shape with a slightly larger screen, right? It was a slightly larger phone, so I assume the screen would have been larger. But anyway, Leo Laporte, I loved what he said towards the end of his live, broadcast on the announcement. He said, you know, the rumor mill got it totally wrong this time.
Yeah.
And boy, that's largely true.
Well, I'll tell you what, last time before I got the iPhone 4, about 3 months before that, I bought a Mophie juice pack for my 3GS, and it's sitting in a drawer right now, not being used. And so then, since we were going to Europe, I bought a Mophie juice pack in the end of July. And so now I've pre-ordered a 4S, and thankfully my juice pack, I'll still be able to use it with the new phone.
Hey, there you go.
So I won't have to buy all new accessories. And so that's a bonus. But,
well, you're lucky you got your order in yesterday. If I wanted to do mine today, I'm, I I was planning on it. I'm not going to get it on October 14th. It sounds like.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The latest Mac Rumors post says, you know, they're quoting 1 to 2 weeks now. So what? I'd be out to October 20th or something.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So what's the deal? Kinda... What's the deal on Sprint? So Phil, you're on Sprint now.
Yes, I am.
I know it's kind of your opinion that they're kind of betting the farm on the iPhone.
Yeah, I think there's a lot. I mean, they've trimmed back on a lot of other services, offering other services. Obviously, they're spending. They're really kind of putting everything they can into using the iPhone to get people on board, and still. And the big, you know, unique selling proposition for them is we still have unlimited plans. So they're pretty much, you know, burning the furniture just to make sure that they can continue to offer unlimited access. But I don't know. I'm pretty excited about getting it. I'm ready for an upgrade. I may get it. I'm going to wait for a while, obviously, but just to see how things shake out and get past the rush at the Sprint store.
Yeah.
But yeah, I believe that clearly, and I think that the industry believes that this is a big gamble for Sprint to see if they can get enough people through the door by using the iPhone 4S and then keeping them and converting them as strong customers.
Well, one of the things that I'm wondering about too, and Julio and Tim specifically, because you guys both have different views on the market and how people are using devices and so forth. You know, Julio, you're clearly focused on the device as a mass tool for everyone. Uh-huh. And Tim from a marketing perspective and so on. One of the trends that I've been seeing is responsive design. And so a lot of the really leading theme developers for WordPress and Drupal and Joomla are all creating responsive design frameworks so that it can a website can mold and shape itself to any form factor, whether it's a large size tablet, a 10-inch tablet, or a 7-inch, or a smartphone. And and so that I've been seeing is a really interesting trend, but also that what Tim Cook said about only 5% of the mobile market has been penetrated, which says there's 95% upside, and when you guys look at the market, and you look at the iPhone and the Android phone, is it kind of good to look at them as discrete, or look at smartphones overall and what that is driving as a trend when humans have the ability to pull up any information virtually anywhere they are? So, what do you think, Tim?
Well, I think there's going to be a lot of growth in smartphones, and I think that there's a huge market opportunity in people that just have regular phones right now, particularly outside of the, you know, developing or the developed world, and that this is going to be the way that they're going to access the internet, and it's going to effectively be their computer. So I agree. There's a huge opportunity in mobile, and that's where the future is, clearly.
Yeah. And so, Julio, in terms of iPhone and Android based phones, is it, do you look at it as the smartphone category, or do you look at each one individually and how they're able to go after the mass market?
You mean each platform?
Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting question. The iPhone is still a little bit of a premium device, and one of the reasons for that is there's no prepaid option. Virgin Mobile just sent me one of their latest prepaid phones, and prepaid is, you know, is really kind of huge in these troubled economic times, because it's a good value. And they sent me their latest Android phone, and it completely knocked my socks off. It's a beautiful Android phone. It's not dual core or anything. It's, you know, relatively the specs are relatively modest, but it blows my mind that such an advanced phone is available in a prepaid form. And I'm guessing Apple is probably going to move in that direction at some point.
I did not even know that was even happening.
Android on prepaid?
Yeah. Well, yeah, a prepaid smartphone. Yeah. Oh, sure.
Yeah, it's been around.
Yeah, so it used to be that prepaid phones were like crap, completely crap phones, and if you wanted a nice phone, you had to do the usual contract. The gap has narrowed remarkably. I mean, you can get a really, really nice prepaid phone these days. It blew my mind.
How much is the data plan or something like that?
I just got the phone, so I haven't researched all the details. But I'll tell you. I mean, if you were sitting with me and looking at the phone, you'd be amazed. It's a really nice phone.
Since the 3GS is still in the portfolio, do you expect that to be, you know, offered on, you know, maybe either unlocked for a reasonable price or in a prepaid configuration?
I don't think it is being offered in that way now, but I'm surprised it isn't. But I'm sure, like I said, I'm sure that's going to be an option at some point. The 3GS is free with a contract, right? You can get it for like $0, correct?
Yeah, exactly.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, that's
yeah, the whole. I've railed against the whole wireless contract thing in the past. I think I consider it to be slavery. I'll celebrate when an iPhone is available in a prepaid form.
Yeah, well, you know, the only downside is I keep thinking. So I bought the 64. I pre-ordered the 64 gig 4S. Well, I know.
Show off.
Go ahead. Jeez. No. Well, here's why. Let me just come on. Defend myself, will ya?
It's gonna be iTunes match, and he's got all that John Coltrane music.
Yeah, precisely. No, but in all seriousness, an 8 megapixel camera and the ability to shoot 1080p. Even though I don't think I'd do that, I'd still do 720p. But I'll be using it because I'm constantly dumping stuff off my existing 32 gig because I'm filling it up all the time. Wow. And so that's why I did it, because I know I'll be using the camera more in the 4S than I have been in the past.
Well, I that's always been my complaint about the Evo is that I'm not happy with the camera. It's just it doesn't take as good of pictures as I'd like, and the video is okay but not great. So I'm kind of anxious to take a peek at the iPhone, but I guess I'm a little more patient than even Steve Borsch. I can't imagine this, but I am
really
patient to wait a little bit longer.
So
I want the 5 could come out next week and you won't even know it. You won't even be ready.
Yeah, you're right. You know, no, what'll happen is I'll buy this, and the same thing will happen is my wife will then get the 5, and I'll be like, I'm still carrying around my iPad, and she's got an iPad 2.
Yeah.
But I can't justify getting rid of it. Hey, I wanted to throw out something that, I've been finding really interesting. So Julio, you've been doing an incredible number of Google Plus posts that I really like. I don't know if you've seen some of my comments, but you're really doing a lot, and you're putting a lot of really great content on there. And so here's the question. So for those that really haven't gotten in, that are listening, that haven't gotten into Google Plus yet, the thing that I love about it is it's Twitter that you can actually do some depth. I mean, I'm finding it's almost more interesting than doing than writing a blog, and so the one thing about it is when you do a post, do you choose specific circles and public for most of these?
Well, the way Google Plus is designed is very nice because you can parse. You know, this post can go to these people, another post can go to another circle and so forth. And there's a lot of flexibility, but you know, honestly, I've never done that. All of my posts are go public.
Okay.
I use it as a public. It's Google Plus is a blogging platform. I mean, that's what it is at least for me. I use it as an alternate blog. Some of the stuff I post on there, I'll also post on some of my other blogs. Like when I have a Pioneer Press story, I'll do a post on it and link to the story or to the Pioneer Press blog post. And I'll do that on Facebook, and I'll do that on Google Plus, and I'll do it on Twitter just to maximize visibility. But a lot of stuff that I'm posting, you know, some of the quirkier stuff, I'm doing it only on Google Plus because it's become sort of my blog for quirky stuff that doesn't fit the nerd mold. I have a nerd blog. It doesn't fit the tech mold.
Right.
It's just, you know, kind of offbeat stuff that it fits nicely on the Google Plus platform. And I've become energized about doing this more and more because the level of engagement that I've discovered on Google Plus is, in many cases, eclipses that of my traditional blogs. I have Tumblr blogs and the Pioneer Press blog. And, you know, often there isn't a lot of feedback or engagement with people that are reading that. But on Google Plus, I always get a lot of feedback and pushback, and it's just a very energetic, very it feels like a thriving platform, and it's snowballing as, you know, more and more people are following me. I'm to the point where I'm like at 25% of my Twitter follower count.
Oh wow!
At this rate, Google Plus is going to overtake, you know, the number of people that follow me on Twitter. This is remarkable, and so I'm a big, I've become a big Google Plus, a believer in Google Plus, and one of the reasons for that is kind of a practical little thing. If you post on Google Plus, and you want to augment the post later or fix a typo or just make any changes, you can. I mean, Facebook does not let you do that.
Right.
That's a big deal for me, because then I can like work on a post and add new information. Like yesterday, for instance, I was in downtown St. Paul, and this really weird, wacky parade just as I was parking my car. This
I'm looking at it, yeah.
With segues, and it's like, what crap is that? And so I threw the video on Google Plus and say, I have no idea what this is, but isn't it cool? And then people said, oh, it's this McNally Smith music something or other, and they pointed me to information. So I went back to Google Plus and I updated the post. You can't do that on Facebook. So
that's great.
Even though Facebook has that new timeline feature, I have got my timeline set up, and the timeline is very nice because it gives your area on Facebook a kind of a blog like feel. It doesn't cut it for me because you're sort of restricted in what you can do.
So the one thing that that we all loved, every single one of us, because we've talked about it all, and Julio, you, when you brought on the guy from Posterous at the Blogger Conference last year, same thing, is one of the powerful aspects of Posterous was being able to post to multiple places at once. Mm-hmm. So you know it's the right once, publish many sort of paradigm, and mm-hmm. and Google Plus, I have yet, other than, you know, you put some Chrome plugin info up, which I have a real issue with some of these plugins, because they then have access to everything in your browser, and I'm not real comfortable with that. But that publish once or write once and publish many sort of paradigm, is anything like that available for Google Plus that you found?
Well, the it's partly because Google hasn't fully opened up the platform with APIs that will let people like Posterous harness. I'm feeling a little overwhelmed, because when I post something, I have to post it manually in Google Plus and then go and post it somewhere else. And I have to do this repeatedly, and I can't like go to Posterous and just post once and have it appear everywhere. So anyway, my point is, right now it's a little awkward because, I have to post manually on Google Plus and then I have to then go post somewhere else. And I've the model where I go to Posterous and then post there, and then it just goes everywhere automatically, that is broken down because Google hasn't made it possible for people like Posterous to do this yet. It hasn't, you know, fully released APIs that will let people like Posterous harness this. I talked to the CEO, and he told me he was a little frustrated about that. As soon as Google gives him the tools to do that, he'll jump on that. But once that happens, I'll go back to my beloved Posterous and just post there, and then it'll go to Google Plus, and it'll go to Facebook, and it'll go to Twitter, and I'm looking forward to that, because there's some plugins for Chrome that kind of let you do that. There's one really cool plugin for Chrome that puts Facebook and Twitter checkboxes when you're in Google Plus, and if you're on Facebook, it puts Google Plus and Twitter checkboxes. So regardless of whether you're on Facebook or on Chrome or on Google Plus, you can post automatically to all three networks. But I've discovered it does not work very well. It doesn't have that Posterous awesomeness. It kind of screws things up a little bit.
Okay.
So I'm back to the point where I'm just posting manually everywhere. It's a little time consuming, but I have no choice.
Yeah.
Well, you know, if you post manually everywhere, you also, you're going to probably get a little bit more visibility because of the, for some reason, if you use an RSS feed into Facebook or something like that, you know, you're not getting the SEO benefits of posting separately. So I'm not sure exactly how that works.
It's just that you then have no time to do anything else.
Yeah.
Say, speaking
paste,
of
cut and paste.
Speaking of posterous.
Yeah. Wait a minute.
Posterous, not posterous.
Do you make a post on posterous?
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know why, but posterous reminds me of posthumous.
Posthumous?
Implies they're about to die. And they did get hacked this week, did they not? Did I not read where posterous was down? Did you guys catch that?
Or no, I didn't. No, I didn't see that at all.
I thought I saw something scroll by that says they got hacked, and, you know, and but I didn't go look. But anyway, posthumous has a nasty meaning.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's so amazing because, you know, you see these articles about Tumblr kicking posterous's ass and stuff like that. Mm. And,
Tumblr is and then there's a ton of money. Yep.
And then there's all this Google Plus, you know, energy and acceleration and all of that. And it is to the point where, you know, I look at some of this stuff and sometimes I'm so overwhelmed that I think back on, I think it was Richard Florida that wrote the book called the Paradox of Choice, mm-hmm. where his entire premise, and he had all these examples, his entire premise was when humans are faced with too many choices, they don't make one.
That's right.
They just shut down. And that's kind of...
Yeah, I was going to say, I got to hear that guy debut that book at
PC. Really?
When Esther Dyson had him on stage at PC Forum 2006, which was her swan song for that great event. Yeah, that was a really interesting book.
Yeah.
Concept.
No, it's yep. Barry Schwartz is the guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Not Richard Florida. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, I'll put a link to a TED video that I've sent to other people in the past. It's really a good thing. But you know, in some ways, I got into a really interesting discussion yesterday. So I have one sister that has an Android smartphone. And
she's the black sheep of the Borscht family, by the way.
No. Well, because...
Boy, is that the truth?
No. My other two sisters don't have a smartphone.
Oh.
But the sister that does...
Why don't you give them one, you cheapskate?
Yeah. Right. Yeah, thanks.
Give them your old ones.
You leave me alone. So, but here's the kicker. The kicker is that I had to send her a very gentle email saying, Mary, just so you know, don't type the entire email in the subject line. So she would send like a 3-sentence subject line and there'd be nothing in the body of the email. But it's because she, you know, she's, I don't know, she's 40, 42, something like that. And she just doesn't get it, you know, and all this different stuff popping up and so on and so forth. And I said, well, take it back to the store and have them just walk you through how to use it. And she said, well, I did. And they don't do that. And I thought, okay, well, that's kind of interesting because if she had an iPhone, she could go into the Apple store and they'd sit with her for an hour or two and show her how to use it.
Yeah, amazing.
Well, so be it. Hey, Phil, you had said something about Best Buy dumping.
That was something that happened in the last week, and I just thought we'd touch base on it.
Well, tell us about it.
Well, Napster, Rhapsody bought the subscription base basically from Napster, which I thought was good for Best Buy because they have done absolutely nothing with Napster. So it was just sucking up money. What did they spend? $121 million on that or something like that?
Yeah, and nobody really said what the acquisition price was, but you can bet they lost their ass.
They took a bath, I'm sure. So now Rhapsody has got a bigger subscription base all of a sudden or opportunity for a bigger subscription base. And I believe they're going to call it Napsody. I'm not sure.
That'd be good.
And we talked about this a few weeks ago. And you know, this is kind of one of the pieces that Best Buy, in my mind, really has to get their act together with.
Yeah.
And it looks like they're just going to abandon. So they should just sell Cinema Now, too. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. If they're not going to get into this digital content, streaming content stuff, which you think they would, because they've been selling the analog equivalent with discs and such.
Well, you know, what was interesting was I only heard like probably 6 or 7 minutes of it because I was heading to a meeting, but Robert Stevens was on with Kerry Miller on Minnesota Public Radio talking about the passing of Steve Jobs. And then when I was walking to my meeting, I had to park in a ramp and walk a few blocks. And as I'm walking to the meeting, this just came to me, and you guys can just poo-poo this or whatever, but I thought, the Steve Jobs of Best Buy is Robert Stevens.
Yep.
I mean, when you really think about that guy and what he did to build the Geek Squad and, the kind of person that he is, and he is so incredibly willing to go to all of these events and embrace startups and, you know, mentor and coach and open up Best Buy to these various events and so forth. Mm-hmm.
He's an amazing ambassador. I tweeted him when the Kindle, what's it called? The Kindle Fire came out. And some is that the new one?
Yeah,
$90 one that cost him $206 to make. Yeah, mm-hmm. And somebody tweeted or wrote a piece that said, "Well, what do you do when they break?" It's not like that's one thing that Apple's got over all these things is you get the Genius Bar.
You basically send it back to Amazon and they send you a new one.
Well, but I tweeted to him. I said, "So, Robert, will Geek Squad fix Kindle Fires?" And he immediately tweeted back, and it got retweeted out. You know, if it's got a network and a screen, we'll fix it.
Well, I had somebody tell me at the store. So I went over, and I've been having internet issues like crazy. And so the tech came out from Comcast, and they're going to have to dig up my yard or at least find the cable and replace the splice in there because I've got way too much upload. There's too much noise in the system, and so the uploads are cacking out on me when I'm trying to upload big files. But when the tech was here, I asked him, I said, would it make sense for me to replace this Motorola modem and just go buy one at Best Buy? Because I'm paying $7 a month for it. And he looked at me and kind of broke into a smile, and he said, yes. He said, go to Best Buy and get a DOCSIS 3 modem, and you'll find that your throughput's probably 20 to 25% faster, even with this noise. And he was absolutely right. Huh. And so while I'm at Best Buy, I'm talking to these different guys about stuff. And I had mentioned about accidentally spilling coffee into my MacBook Air and how Apple didn't take care of liquid spills and all of that. But after spending some time at the Genius Bar, the guy ended up saying, okay, well, I'll send it in. And it came back and they'd replaced a bunch of the stuff and didn't cost me anything. And I said I was lucky in that particular case because the guy took pity on me because my daughter's computer had been stolen and so forth. But here's what the guy at Best Buy said. He looked at me and he said, "Oh, do you have AppleCare on that?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, did you know that our their version of AppleCare, I'm not sure what it is, also covers breakage and liquid, and it's roughly the same price." And I did not know if you guys knew that or not, but actually.
I bought a computer for my daughter there, and I did buy their version of AppleCare.
Well, I find that really interesting, especially if I'm up in Fargo, North Dakota, and there's not an Apple store that's close, but there's a Best Buy that's, 5 blocks from my house. How fabulous would that be?
Yeah, really.
And especially with all these mobile devices. I mean, Julio, you have a lot of stuff that's sent to you temporarily from companies so that you can review it. But for your own personal tech, for your own personal mobile tech, do you buy extended warranties? Do you buy an AppleCare, stuff like that?
Well, the one smartphone that I have right now is issued to me by my employer. So my employer is my guarantee. If I break it, my employer will take care of it. Although I did run into a hardware issue the other day, and I debated, should I go to my to the person at work who issued the phone to me and have that person take care of it? And I realized that would have taken a lot longer than just like walking into an Apple store saying, hey, I have a problem, and then have the person respond, okay, here's a new phone. And that took 5 minutes. So
yeah. Well, do you recommend? I mean, like in your columns and stuff, do you recommend to the average consumer that they if they have mobile devices, that they do in fact take out extended warranties if they can afford it?
Well, I'm suspicious of many extended warranties because I'm not really sure to what extent the people issuing the extended warranties will back them up. I just don't trust many retailers, frankly. Okay. I just don't trust them as far as I can throw them. But my experience with Apple generally has been so good that I advise people that, you know, to just get the AppleCare. Like, for instance, with my Mac, my iMac here at home, when you buy a Mac, you get a year, and then you can bump that up to 3 years. And I got to the end of the year, and then about another couple of weeks passed, and I told myself, well, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to bother. Mm-hmm. But then about 2 weeks passed, and I had this, I just woke up in a cold sweat, in bed one night, and it's like, that was a mistake. I shouldn't have done that. And I called Apple on the phone. I said, yeah, I know I'm past a couple of weeks, but you know, please, can you help me out here? I'm having second thoughts. I would like the extended warranty. And, you know, they, no problem. They gave it to me. And I will thank the God, thank gods that I did that, because I had problems with the Mac later, and that AppleCare just more than paid for itself. I my wife was skeptical when I paid the money for the AppleCare, and I redeemed myself in her eyes, because we would have been out a bunch of money if I hadn't done that.
Well, and look what happened to you, Phil, when you had a logic board problem. You got a new computer, right?
Yeah, I had a video chip that NVIDIA video chip that they were having troubles with basically led to them replacing the MacBook Pro. And you know, so I upgraded from the first version, or you know, the first iteration of MacBook Pro to the unibody, and got more power and all that sort of stuff. And I was pretty giddy about that. I thought that was the thing that said, yep, this is going to be my platform. I know it's more money, but you know, being able to get all that access and get that taken care of with Apple is that's a big deal to me.
Well, it happened to one of my clients, who is a dyed-in-the-wool PC guy, George Johnson, and George had exactly the same experience. So when it came time for him to buy a laptop for his wife, and he asked me if he could get one for $600 or $700, and I said, "Well, not a new one." And then I said, "Well, if that's really your budget for it, then you'll have to go with a PC, and I would recommend you go here and so on." And he just said, "Wait, just stop. Just so you know, I'm never buying a PC again." Now, for him to say that was pretty amazing. And it was later on that he had that experience where his cacked on him, and they just said, "Well, we'll just give you a new computer." Yeah, so,
had the same thing happen. I've had some amazing things happen at the Genius Bar. I love the way they empower those guys to do things in special situations, and that's a shout out to the way Steve Jobs and company really changed retailing in a lot of ways too. Just one of many things they did. And a shout out to Ron Johnson for the fabulous, you know, Apple stores. I mean, good Lord, what an amazing accomplishment over less than 10 years to have that machine working for them, you know.
Yeah.
And creating happy customers, you know, all day long. You go into those places and there's, you know, there's 4-year-olds to 85-year-olds, and they're all like beaming, you know.
I didn't tell you the full story of what happened with the iPhone. That I went into the Apple store, and I was having this issue, this hardware issue, what I thought was a hardware issue. And I handed it to this guy, say, "I'm having this problem. Can you take a look at it?" And he went back and, you know, spent a half an hour with the phone, and he came back and he said, "The problem you're describing, I'm not seeing. I can't find anything wrong, but I found this other problem. And that I was not aware of. I found this other problem that looks like it's an issue, and therefore I'm going to give you a new phone." Wow. And that just kind of blew my mind.
Yeah, they go above and beyond. You know, it's the service. You know, that's what you're buying in large part. You know,
well, so, you're buying the entire experience.
You are absolutely.
Yeah. That was what Steve Jobs was really good at, is really optimizing that entire experience, which includes the hardware, includes the software, includes the design, includes the customer experience inside the retail store.
Absolutely.
And the post-sale service. All of that stuff is the customer experience.
Yep.
And I don't think any other company or any other CEO of a company really understood that. And that's really where his secret sauce was understanding that complete customer experience.
Well, the New Yorker has a, and I'll put a link in the show notes, has a cover story on Steve Jobs at the Pearly Gates, and he's standing there and St. Peter's got an iPad.
Yeah.
And so I'll have to take a look at that. But one of the comments down below is, Steve, what do you think about heaven? Steve says, it's nice, but it's no Apple Store. I just had to throw that in.
And the New Yorker did have that great piece on Steve's visit to Park back in the day when he, you know, was turned on to the mouse technology that Park was working on at the time at the Xerox Park facility. And that's a great read as well in the New Yorker. Let's talk a little bit about, I see this. We've got a link in the show notes to the Wall Street Journal post of who will be the next Steve Jobs.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's folly to say, let's start looking for the next visionary. Let's start looking for the next Steve Jobs. I think he was brilliant, but let's also remember that what his real brilliance was assembling the people around him to make these things happen.
Right.
It's not, Steve did not sit in that same garage making the iPhone 4S or making the iPhone or the iPad or the iPod. He wasn't making these things. He was the visionary that was pushing these things through, and he really was the face of the company in its later years. But there are a lot of people that make Apple go. There are a lot of people that make.
Well, and somebody brought him the iPad, and they decided that that they would do the phone first, and get it into everybody's hands to sort of prep everyone for this next paradigm shift. And rather than do the tablet first, they basically took all the concepts and shrunk it down to the phone. And so, to your point, Jeff Raskin was the one who did the whole plan for the Macintosh back in the early '80s, and Steve, was on the Lisa project and then ended up moving to the Mac project and turned out to lead that. And one could argue, yes, he absolutely took it to the next level. But it wasn't him personally generating and germinating all of these ideas. I mean, he was the one that, was able to make it all happen, to drive the company in a certain direction.
Mm-hmm.
He was the motivator, and he was the last arbiter of what was going to stay in the product and what wasn't.
Right.
So that whole curation process of understanding, okay, this isn't right, and this is the way it needs to be, that's the part that hopefully they've institutionalized within Apple. I know they've been working on that over the last 5 or 6 years.
Well,
so
there was a really...
If they've been able to instill that process through the company, then the company is going to do fine.
Yep. Well, I gotta ask, and again, Steve, I know that you've been in this space a lot longer than I have, but back in the day, wasn't Steve kind of considered a dick?
He didn't suffer fools gladly,
right?
And so now some of this might be apocryphal, but when I went back, after Jobs came back, about a year later, they were looking for somebody to run the business group in Minnesota. And so I joined Apple, and I was there a couple years. And at that point, I had heard, kind of through the grapevine, people were talking, because we knew a couple of engineers out in Cupertino, that when Steve had come back, because the company was bleeding money to the point where, it's come out now that Apple was almost out of business. And if it hadn't been for $150 million from Microsoft and Microsoft's agreement to keep Microsoft or Mac Office going for another 5 years, which was a good thing for Microsoft because, remember, they were through that whole antitrust issue. And so they wanted to keep Apple alive as well. But Jobs brought everybody in for different product categories. And, the printer people that had Apple labels on Canon printers and HP printers and all that, his thing was, why are we in that business? Why do we not partner with these people rather than build it, we're out of that business. Same thing with the QuickTake camera. We're out of that business. The Newton, they'd lost $500 million on. And, you know, the story is he picked it up and threw it on the ground, said this thing's a piece of shit. So, you know, we're done with it. And it's just stuff like that, that you hear those stories and you think, oh God, he was just an ass. And, he didn't suffer fools gladly, as it turns out. And also he just had to cut to the chase. He didn't have time to screw around. He had to say, you know, he wanted to save the company. And it's the same thing now. You look at the Apple stores and the stuff that people can't do, there are some pretty strict guardrails around what people can and cannot do, but it makes perfect sense because otherwise you'd have people telling everyone stuff that isn't true or their own opinion and so on. And for the most part, the stores are in lockstep with what Apple's doing overall. So,
yep.
Yeah. Well, guys, we should wrap and get on down the road here.
Well, let's talk about what's coming up.
What's obviously coming up?
We have a big week for us at the MEMA Summit. Of course, Minovate will be there, as we always are, in full Minovate regalia, whatever that is.
Does that mean we're going to have shirts?
No, we'll be there. We'll be doing obviously the live blogging as we tend to do. We'll also be doing some video. They'll have a back channel going as throughout the event with live video, and so we'll be doing interviews with those that are involved. So we'll hope to see you, have you tune in and listen a little bit if you can't make the MEMA Summit. If not, we'll see you there. And that happens on Tuesday and Wednesday
of next this week.
Yep. Tuesday is the workshops. Yeah. Wednesday is the full on thing.
Thursday, I gotta give a big.
Yeah, go ahead, Julio.
I'm speaking at the MEMA Summit. You know that, right?
Yes, you are.
Yeah.
Okay. Excellent.
We'll be there. I would love to see you get a real picture, not just your cartoon avatar. You know, you're a handsome man.
Ah, shucks.
But yes, Julio will be there. A lot of our friends will be there, so hopefully you can make it as well.
It is one of the best regional shows that I would argue is as good as any of the national shows and events. It's really well done.
Yep. And then I was going to say the next day, I want to give a big shout out to the Collaboratives Venture Finance Conference all day Thursday. Actually starts with a reception Wednesday night. This is the 25th annual, and I had a great conversation with Dan Carr yesterday about this. This is a really big deal. When you start looking at the influence that this organization has had over 25 years, helping to make Minnesota the eighth largest innovation state, if you count the number of VC-backed jobs in the state. So I'm going to put a link in the show notes about that. And Dan wrote a column on this actually some time ago. And Neil St. Anthony at the Tribune just wrote a recent piece that referred to those stats again and paid tribute to this guy. He's a good friend and a heck of a leader that's built quite a substantial networking and conference organization. And he's now got over 400 people paying some pretty good money to go to this thing, and there's going to be a bunch of great startups pitching, and he's got more startups than ever doing the 1 minute pitches and having, you know, a table at the event. I don't know how many there are. There's probably 20 or 30 some doing that. So anyway, big shout out to Dan.
Yep. Great. And then Product Camp Minnesota is coming up on Saturday, but that's the 12th of November. And then,
We got that social media breakfast is happening on the 28th.
You are right.
And let's just call them the babes of social media, shall we? Meg Knodel and Lisa Graham will be doing a little talk on community management.
Yeah, they're going to appreciate that.
I'm sure they're going to really appreciate that.
These
are incredibly smart women, so you got to check it out. It's really a great event.
Yep. And I would also encourage everybody, in all of the articles about Steve Jobs, and there are hundreds of them out there and posts and so on, that Julio, you did one with a local twist with Peter Tamte and Mike Evangelist that I thought was really, really well done. And
I did too. I really, really liked it. That, Julio. Thank you for writing that. I was waiting for that to come out, you know.
And yeah, thanks for the compliments on the post, but my standard response is you really need to go to Mike Evangelist's blog. Just go straight to the source and spend a couple of hours there and get the unfiltered information, because some of his stories about his interactions with Steve Jobs are just absolutely riveting. And I only distilled it. I just got a flavor of it in the pieces that I wrote. But if you go there, you're going to find some really, really good stuff.
I'll put a link I'll put a link in the show notes.
Yeah, it's writersblocklive.com.
Yep.
Yeah, right. I talked to his boss, Matt Dornquist, at Mini Demo the other night, and he told me that Mike was still so shook up he didn't even come to Mini Demo. And I said, well, I can well imagine. But it's fascinating to read the history of what his experience was with Steve.
Well, and you know, it's I actually thought for a long time that when I had heard the name of Mike Evangelist that he was out there, I thought the guy actually changed his name to his job title.
Yeah,
I did.
Yeah, what a perfect name, you know.
Yeah. Yep.
But it is his real name, right?
Yeah, yeah, it is. It is.
Yeah, he has one post on his blog where he says, "I'm Mike Evangelist, and I should contact the Apple evangelist." And you know, how cool is that? I don't know if that was Guy Kawasaki or who, but he said, you know, the that just made a lot of sense. And he actually got very close to being hired at that point, because he did a HyperCard resume.
Oh, interesting.
The people at Apple were kind of wowed by that, and they came very close to hiring him. They sort of languished, but he did get hired later. So
fascinating.
All right, well, I think that's about it, gentlemen. And
well, it was good to be back, guys. I'm glad you were able to join us. And
thank you.
Onward and upward. It's going to be a busy week next week, and we'll recap it all on the next Minute of Eight Gang podcast, right?
Thanks, everyone, for listening. Take care, guys.
Have a great weekend.
Bye-bye.
You too.
She's even meaner. She's even meaner.
Well, if you
shop. She handles all my money. I just play guitar. I give her all my loving. She's the one I want. Do my honey do's and then she says, honey, don't. I got a woman.